know, I've heard some speakers that were hard acts to follow. But for the introduction to make it so difficult is not quite fair, I think. At any rate, hearing so charming and humorous number of comments as that, it's clear that the only thing for a rational speaker to do is jump into the heat of the issue of judicial review and intent and not try and make any jokes in competition. That's my one effort. A couple of weeks ago, I had tremendous pleasure of reading the manuscript of a new book that you will all be reading and talking about very soon. This is Bernard Segan's The Supreme Court's Constitution. As you might imagine, this is a marvelous statement of a variety of explanations of how the Supreme Court has managed to move very far from the original intent. This is also a very strong statement for another reason. It is an extremely clever and professional brief for the proposition that Professor Segan advances. But it is nonetheless a brief, as indeed I think I would characterize some of the other addresses on this topic that you've heard today and perhaps yesterday. As a legal brief, of course, there is a certain suspicion about the intention underlying it. As intellectual history, one knows that there can be a certain picking and choosing of the parts that stand for the thesis you wish. One thing a brief is not is proof of a proposition. I think, however, that too often, not always to be sure, but too often, we are presented briefs for these propositions when we really ought to be presented a different kind of material. I think a great deal of this argument going on currently about original intent versus humanistic reading of the transcendent idea of the Constitution exactly falls prey to that criticism. I think that we are hearing briefs for a proposition. Now, a legal brief is an instrumental document designed to achieve some specific concrete and substantive end. That's where our concern should be placed, not on the methodological arguments. At any given time or any given point in the course of legal history, the nature and the quality of the best, the winning kind of brief is going to change. That necessarily is true. Our concepts of logic change, our concepts of semantics change, our concepts of psychology change. As these things happen, it necessarily changes the style of arguments that lawyers make. The argument that's made today about the original intent of the Constitution is not the same argument that was made about that same topic 100 years ago. 100 years ago, there was a different kind of consensus that allowed people to start at a different point entirely from which we start today. Too many things have happened in our intellectual history since that time to expect that those arguments would be the same. Now, that does not mean that there's not an appropriate place to make the kind of talk that the Attorney General addressed today, or certainly, in even more scholarly terms, Bernie Segan addresses in this new book of his. What I want to try and do on the general subject of judicial review is show you why I think these intent arguments may be a little weak, and indeed offer you what I think is a much more meaningful kind of argument on this subject. The issue of judicial review, that is, the reviewability of legislative actions by the courts, is one that, whether everyone in this room knows it or not, is not so much as once mentioned in the Constitution of the United States. There has been a debate going on at least since Marbury v. Madison, when Justice Marshall advanced the notion, as to whether that was correct. There were certainly political explanations for what Marshall did at the time. At any rate, one cannot find it there. You can make some very interesting and strong arguments. Certainly over the years, we've seen them. Nonetheless, the doctrine of judicial review, particularly of Supreme Court review of congressional acts, has waxed and waned over the years. Today, when a great deal of the particularly left-leaning intellectual community favors the actions of a Congress over any great effort to restrain their proclivities, we're not so happy with it. Certainly, this accounts for always pointing to the great failure of judicial review that was the Dred Scott case. The issue is not so simple, however. First of all, with apologies to the lawyers present for whom this is commonplace, we start before the question of intent with what some scholars have distinguished as the meaning rather than the intent. This gives rise to a notion that lawyers and judges frequently allude to, that the first thing you do is look at the plain meaning of the words. If the meaning is plain, so be it. If it says that someone has to be 25 years old to be a member of the House of Representatives, that's pretty plain. 25 is fairly concrete. You can't say, although occasionally a case goes the other way, but normally you can't say, well, that really means 26 or it really means 24. It means 25. But saying an age has to be 25 is quite different from saying that someone is entitled to due process of law or the equal protection of laws. These are very different kinds of concepts. And the more generalized the concept is, obviously, the less clear the meaning of the word is, and the less applicable the plain meaning rule is. At that point, we begin to search for intent. Here we begin to run into trouble. The problems of finding intent have been well discussed in much of the literature, most recently by a young Harvard a political scientist by the name of Macedo, whom I'm sure some of you know, and may be on this program. The arguments run a gamut of things. Public choice theory currently teaches us, for instance, the impossibility of ever deducing a group utility, a social welfare function, as they call it. And that can be converted into a proof that there is no such thing as an intent that derives from a substantial group, or even perhaps a very small one under special circumstances. The problem, therefore, without spending any more time on that issue, because pretty soon Danny's going to start gaveling me down, is that this question of intent can be used on just about any side of an issue. Now, the truth is that intent arguments, usually for historical reasons or a variety of reasons, may be stronger on one point than another. Right now, for instance, if one wants to make arguments about the protection of property rights, intent arguments are pretty good. That is, we can go back and we can see that the Founding Fathers were concerned about this matter, and we can argue that this is part of the thinking that they brought into the Constitution and that therefore it was intended when they used phrases like due process and some others of that sort. The point, however, is that we use these arguments instrumentally. We shouldn't go around, therefore, concluding that there is some sacred obligation always to seek out original intent. Because I can assure you that if we were in a different era of history right now, if property rights were being well protected, and if the historical argument cut the other way, one would not hear the present Attorney General of the United States arguing that we should get back to original intent, because if you did, it would mean, under the hypothetical I put to you, that you're not going to protect property rights and a lot of other things that this group would like to see. What I'm suggesting to you is that our principle does not transcend our interest, that interests are really what this argument is all about, and that intelligent people considering it seriously are going to look to see what it is they desire, and they're not going to be hung up on some idea that you must in some almost religious way, seek out the intent of a group that can't be ascertained anyway. What should we do about an issue like judicial review? Basically, the question is, who do we trust more? 500 or 600 elected officials sitting in Congress, or 9 appointed lawyers on the Supreme Court of the United States? That's the way it's often characterized, and people line up on whether they like appointed, a small number of appointed officials versus a large number of elected officials, and one hears all the cant about the importance of elections and representations and democracy and so forth. I'm here to argue very strongly that whatever utilitarian selection we make, whether it's an original intent argument or a clear meaning argument or something else, that it is very much in the interest of all of us to recognize that there is only, at this point, one extremely dangerous branch of the United States government, and that is the legislative branch. The legislative branch has powers that the court can't begin to touch, that as soon as you begin to enumerate them and think about them, you realize that we're not talking about things of comparable power at all. Just as a simple listing, courts can't tax you. They can raise costs a little bit, but nothing like Congress can do. Courts can't draft people into the military. Courts can't declare war. Courts can't initiate any action. Courts can't select political enemies and proceed in some way against them. Courts can't significantly add to the regular harm that's done through regulatory statutes. The list can go on and on. Look, if you will, at Congress. I dare say that if given the choice of repealing every law that the Congress of the United States has adopted in this century, most of us would conclude that on balance, the harm has outweighed the good. That on balance, if we simply made a random throw of darts at a listing of all the laws passed, if we could get rid of them, we'd be better off. Now, that's somewhat my view of the court. I don't think the court is ever going to be a perfectly consistent and very nicely engineered instrument for reaching just the bad laws that we don't want and knocking them out. In fact, I'd be a little concerned if I thought the court really had that power. I don't think they do. I agree very much with Judge Frank Easterbrook on the proposition that, among other things, the voting scheme that's used in the United States Supreme Court guarantees a tremendous amount of randomness in what they do. That is, that it is impossible in a great many cases, in any sense, to make an accurate prediction from what has gone before of what's going to follow. I think that's fine. That is exactly the reason why I would strengthen the concept of judicial review. The more acts of Congress that a court can randomly declare unconstitutional, the better off we all are. Now, what's the chance that we're going to see some new renaissance of notions like substantive due process and a heightened sensitivity to the court's power to declare acts unconstitutional? It's still done with state legislation. It is almost unheard of, not quite. We recently saw just a tiny, tiny blip with the Graham-Rudman litigation. What's the chance we're going to see more of this? I think the chance is very good. I think, and I'm being very optimistic here, that we are living at the tail end of an era that began in the 1930s. I think we are seeing, in such an intellectual preposterous proposition as the decision, the court's opinion in Roe v. Wade, that the left, as represented on the court or anywhere else, in this country today is very nearly intellectually bankrupt. Now, that was not true in the 1930s. There were a lot of concepts around then that were really believed by the best minds in the country, and not only believed, there wasn't any strong intellectual opposition to such notions as the real power of majoritarian democracy to represent the interests of the people, that private property had become largely an anachronism, that we could regulate private property to gain public goods from the use rather than merely private goods, that we could reallocate wealth in utter disregard of economic consequences, and finally, that the courts could and should participate in that process. Well, that was a strongly held belief of the 30s. It derived from intellectual activities of the preceding decades. It's gone today. Oh, it's still around. If you took a head count of people who believe those things in universities, you'd certainly still find it. By and large, however, there has been a sea change. There is an understanding today of the power of markets, of private property, and of the weaknesses of the political process. After all, Jim Buchanan's Nobel Prize certainly stood for that proposition more than anything else. I think in the long run, that's really how constitutional doctrine is made. I don't know how many intellectual generations it will take for the modern law and economics revolution in the law schools and public choice theory and things of that sort to have an impact on the thinking of our courts, but I have no doubt that it will, and I have no doubt that the impact of that is going to be to strengthen the hand of the court in dealing with the absurdities that often we get from our legislatures. Thank you.